When we got to that Portland game, we absolutely had to win that game.
That's awesome.
Absolutely had to win it. Like, there was no, it was us or them at that point.
Yeah.
I'd had a very good season. You know, I had some big games, but it was what was riding on that game that, mm-hmm. that gave me, like, this different kind of confidence, this different kind of air about me. And then, yeah, like, I don't even know what happened. Like, I don't know. I blinked. The game was over. I was like, oh, my God, we won. I had 33 points. What the hell just happened? It was wild.
That is so cool, man.
And then, oh, wait, sidebar. So the next game, guess how many points I had?
How many?
Zero. I went from dropping 33 to dropping none.
Every Hall of Famer has experienced it. Every MVP has gone through it. Every All-Star has endured it. It is a unifying experience amongst all professional athletes, the perennial superstars, and the ones who couldn't quite grasp it. For some, it is a memory they hold dear and remember with great nostalgia. For others, it was a horror show they would love to forget. But for every single professional athlete, it's the one thing they all have in common. Rookie year.
Your government name, Suzanne Bridget Byrd. I mean, that by itself is, that's amazing.
It's official.
But commonly known as Sue Bird, American basketball player, professional for Seattle Storm women's national team. Sue drafted by the Storm first overall in 2002. She holds a front office position with the Denver Nuggets. She's also played in Russia. And what I tell everyone, the greatest female player of all time.
Hey, I knew I liked you.
It is an absolute honor to have you on here. And I've had the opportunity to get to know you a little bit through our friend Tim Conley. But I, having two daughters and you being the role model that you are, I am truly honored to have you on and have you here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So you had, once again, the greatest career of maybe any collegiate player. How many games did you lose in your whole college career?
Not a lot. Single digits. I think like four.
Yeah. So, yeah, exactly. You were 114-4 as a collegiate athlete. And we'll get into the accolades you had in college later on. But you come right out. You get drafted. First thing you did when you get drafted?
First thing I did. I mean, honestly, the way the WNBA works, it's like your college season ends.
Yep.
You have like, at that point, I think like 2 weeks to situate yourself, like finish school, pack things up. For me, I was lucky enough to win a couple of awards. So I was like bopping around, accepting those. And then boom, you're drafted. And because it happens like all so fast, you're literally like on a plane the next day. You have
crazy.
No time to think. So it's like the first thing I did was go report to my team. Like, oh, no joke. God. Like, you might have a couple days again, like I said, to finish some packing and like get your dorm room situated and make sure everything's good. But it happens so fast. So one of the first things I did was pack my bags for Seattle.
That's crazy.
It's wild. Yeah.
And you go in and now, you know, because you were kind of in uncharted territory. I mean, even in 02, the league itself hadn't grown to the level that it is now.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that you were one of the huge, you had been one of the stars, kind of getting the notoriety, getting the Nike deal, getting the Amex deal as a spokesman.
Right.
Were you the biggest star on your team overnight?
Yeah, kind of. And some of that was I was still riding that UConn wave. Like, UConn has a ton of notoriety. So when you go there and you're a former UConn player or you just finished your college career, you already have a name. You know, you're already, we were just in the Final Four. So like my season started, like I said, probably like a month after winning the Final Four, which is like
That's
a huge buzz thing. So
yeah,
I kind of hit the scene hard. It's actually funny because the Seattle Storm had the number one pick prior to my rookie year, so the year before, and we drafted Lauren Jackson, who's like amazing. I mean, like, if you really want to talk GOATs, right, there's probably like a top three that you can really put in there, like Diana Taurasi, the Lisa Leslies. Okay, Cheryl Swoops, Lauren Jackson's like right up there. Like, she is legit.
I definitely agree with that.
But then I got there and she was like, whoa, who's this number one pick who's getting all the attention?
Yeah.
So I was like the new kid in on the block, and she didn't like it.
You know what? That is so funny. That happens across every single sport. It happened with me and Kwame Brown.
Mm-hmm.
So Kwame was the number one pick the year before, and Doug Collins set me up when they drafted me on my draft night interview, Doug was there. He goes, we got somebody that'll really push Kwame now and hopefully make him the player he can be. And I'm like, oh
dang,
my.
Dude, so
he never did like me. He never did like me after that. So you get there. Have you started every single game that you've ever played in?
In the WNBA, yeah.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, I have. Yeah.
That's actually really crazy. So you get there, day one, hit the ground running.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, talk about practices. Are there any nerves? Or because you kind of knew you had a starting role, you just kind of assimilated really fast. What was that kind of thinking?
Well, I didn't know I had the starting role. I mean,
yes,
in some
did.
Ways,
okay.
No, there was actually a point guard there, Sonya Henning, who...
okay, yeah, I remember her.
So I'm 21 at the time. She's like 35. And yeah. She's like been there, done that, won championships in the WNBA. I believe won at Stanford as well.
Yeah.
So the thing that I did know, though, was that this was, you know, a team that by drafting me one, especially in the point guard spot, they were essentially giving me the keys, you know, and especially with Lauren there, having this kind of duo, they were giving us the keys. So even though I wasn't positive, you know, I didn't go in there thinking like, this is my team, my spot, not at all. But in the back of my head, I was like, okay, as training camp went, I was like, all right, I think this is kind of the road they're going down. Like, they're just going to, like, let Lauren and I kind of, you know, get our sea legs. Like, just kind of let us learn, throw us to the fire, basically, is what I'm trying to say.
And what was the hardest thing, like, in your first few games? I mean, for me, honestly, it was just the lack of atmosphere, if that makes sense. Like, I came from Indiana.
Yeah.
And
I remember,
mean,
you guys.
Every single game was rocking. It was awesome. And then all of a sudden I get to, like, NBA games and there's, you know, 3,000 fans in Atlanta. Even though MJ was playing, it was all the fans were there for MJ. The fans weren't there for us. They were here,
right.
They were there to see MJ's last year. They could care less about us.
Yeah.
Was that hard? Like, was that hard for you? Because, I mean, obviously, all your games are sold out. Like, you guys rock. UConn, national titles. Now, you know, now you're in the league. You're playing pro. What was the biggest change for you, the biggest, hardest thing for you from, like, those first 10 to 12 games?
Yeah, you said it. It was atmosphere. We had, like you said, at Connecticut, we were always sold out. So on campus, it was 10,000 a game. We had an off-campus in Hartford arena that held 16. Sold out. Whether we were playing, you know, the number two team, or we were playing like the worst team in our conference. Sold out, didn't matter. So that was definitely an adjustment. I think the biggest one was I didn't lose much in college. And when we did lose, it was the end of the world for everybody. You know, the coaches, the player, everybody. So I remember one of, was it the first game? Yeah, I think our very first game. We lost by like a lot, like 15, 20 points. And I'm in the locker room. I'm like kicking stuff. I'm like, what the, you know, like getting pissed. And everyone's kind of looking at me like, yeah, but where do you want to go to dinner tonight? And I was like, what?
Yeah.
Like, why isn't everybody mad? Like, this is supposed to be the end of the world. And so I quickly learned, like, okay, this is professional sports. You're going to lose, so you can't act like it's the end of the world. So I learned that pretty quickly. I think as, like, the number one pick, there was, you know, just a lot of talk about me and not so much pressure, but it was just, there was a light that was shining a little bit on me.
Yeah.
And so I found out, like, playing against these older players, they didn't always love that. So, you know, I had my fair share of, there was one team, the LA Sparks, where they had this point guard, Nikki McCrimmon. I'll, like, never forget this. And apparently she had, like, a bounty on my head. Like, somebody put a bounty, like, if you strip her at half court, like, two or three times, we'll pay you X. So, I, you know, after, I didn't find out till later, and she did get me, which just kills me, because she did get me. And I found out after, and I was like, oh, like, no wonder, because she was, like, picking me up full court, doing all the extra, and I was like, what is going on? Because usually that doesn't happen.
Yeah,
there,
yeah.
There was a bounty. And then another time on, like, the handshake line, this player was like, hey, you know, I really love what you're doing for the league. I appreciate it. And it was just, there was something about the tone where I was like, I don't think that was serious.
Yeah,
I don't think she's being
in a nice way.
I'm like, that, I feel like you're hating on me hard right now, aren't you? Okay, thanks, gotta go, bye.
No,
but like,
I mean,
yeah, so I felt all of that at the start.
Yeah, and you do. I mean, I think if you could walk through basketball and you've been lucky enough, you know, being in New York City, being all these other places, there is a level of, lack of a better term, racism in sports. Like, I was always the light-skinned kid. Like, I'd walk into the gym, I'd be the light-skinned kid.
Yeah.
Everybody would just go at me. obviously, if you walk in, because you walk in, you played in every kind of environment.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you never backed down. You never shied away from it. What was, we could go for all levels of basketball. What was the hardest level of basketball? Was it high school for you, college, or pros? I mean, high school for you was crazy because, I mean, you were in the middle of it.
Yeah, high school, I mean, obviously, you can't compare. Like, professional is definitely the hardest.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Every game, I'll put it this way. The pros, the games are hard. Like, especially when you get into the playoffs. I mean, these are grinds. Yeah. The series, you're seeing the same team over and over. You got to grind it out. For college, what was difficult was practice. Our prices were just incredibly hard. You'd go crazy long hours. You never could get, you know, even if you did it perfect, it wasn't perfect enough.
Yeah.
And then the games at the end were hard because at UConn, there was so much pressure to win. Like, there was a year, my junior year, we got to the Final Four, but we lost. And it was not good enough. Whereas other schools get celebrated just for making it there. So it's kind of different in that way.
That's true. I mean, for me, like, high school was always one of the hardest things because Indiana basketball was so big.
Yeah.
But, like, our high school games from my sophomore, junior, senior year, we were doing, like, 5,000 to 6,000 fans.
That's crazy.
It was crazy in high school. And it was the same thing. We didn't lose. So when we did lose, it was, like, the end of the world. And, like, you know, newspaper articles are writing about it. So I think it's always interesting people's journey to where they're getting to those, you know, to the pros. The pros, you're right. The games are hard because people don't understand how good everybody is.
Exactly. It's like you've been weeded out at that point. Like, all the dead weight has been weeded out. There's nobody that's bad. It's just, you know, we're in college. There's always going to be someone on the court who's like, you could pick on them a little bit. In the pros, not really.
You've spoken about your sister being your biggest influence. How does she inspire you? Like, how does she, you know, her, what she did really inspire the other player?
Yeah, I mean, the thing about my sister, she's 5 years older, so it's kind of that weird age gap where we're not really doing the same things at the same time. I really just had somebody that I could watch them go through something knowing, like, I was on deck for it in a couple of years.
Yeah.
You know, so watching her... when she first started playing sports, or, you know, she's like an incredibly smart woman and, you know, ended up going to like an Ivy League school, ended up going to an Ivy League law school. Now she's actually a legal recruiter. She just has a lot of success in her life, quote unquote, off the court. And but it was great to watch somebody succeed. I basically had a front row seat at what success looked like, you know, and what hard work looked like and what it meant to have a goal and want to achieve it. And like I said, I literally got to see that every day. And because of that 5-year age gap, you know, it really set me up where I was like, okay, in a couple of years, you know, when I'm looking at colleges or, you know, when I have to do this or I have to do that, and I really could look back on what my sister went through and how she did it and kind of draw from that. So it was really great.
Your parents, I mean, did your parents push you to play sports, or was it just kind of a natural thing, like, hey, whatever you want to do?
Yeah, no, they let me kind of figure it out. They let me do what I wanted. It all kind of came naturally, which is great. I think, you know, my dad was an athlete in college. He ran track. My mom's actually, she's not an athlete per se, but she's still pretty, like, at the time, she was still really active.
Yeah.
So that was, like, an important part of our lives. Like, we always did stuff. Like, my dad's really big into water skiing and, like, water sports stuff. So we, like, we're always doing that. I don't know. Like, I don't remember asking to join sports teams. So I feel like they must have, like, just put me in them, but it stuck. And then they could see that it stuck.
It's the same thing. I mean, I look now, like, kids just start playing when they're, like, 5, 6 years old, which is, every parent's different, but my parents never pushed me. My parents were like, you want to do this? And I was so oblivious to it. I would just go outside and play outside. And we always played basketball.
Same.
We played football, played basketball, played baseball, but I never played for any leagues. And then, like, one day I was in a league, and I'm not sure, same thing. I'm not sure.
Like, I don't know how it happened, but they must have known. But, like, for sure, it was, like, my neighborhood, you'd be like, ding dong, can, like, Tommy come play? Ding dong, ding dong, you know, can Joey come play? And, like, you were playing something. Like, whether it was basketball, football, like, you name it, you were playing something. So I think it did come naturally to me. And then, one day I was just on teams. I'm like, I don't even know how it happened.
What did your schools come down to? So you have this great high school career, you go through it. What school did you come down to before your own choice?
Well, obviously Connecticut, and then the other two were Stanford and Vanderbilt. And then I had, like, two others kind of on the outskirts, but those are the only three that I visited.
Thank God you went to UConn.
I know, man. It's so bizarre looking back. Those schools seem so random now.
Yeah.
I mean, I shouldn't say that. I feel bad, they feel very random.
I was scouting for the Nuggets.
Mm-hmm.
I'd never been to Stanford. I had never been to like Cal Berkeley, never been to Vanderbilt. Yeah. And I ended up having to go to those schools and scout. I was like, thank God I went to Indiana. Because I mean, part of going to college is to like, have fun. Like, have fun, go to the bars, go to parties. If you go to those schools, you're just there, man. Like, and they're pretty campuses and they're great towns, but like, you're just there. But they're very random places.
Yeah. It's funny because like, now I see how, like, now I feel that those schools are random, but then it's like at the time, UConn had only one. So they obviously now they've got 11. So Coach Raymond has 11 national championships, which is insane.
That's crazy.
But when I was getting recruited, they only had one and it was 95. So now it's like I'm getting recruited like 97, 98. So they've been to some Final Four since, but they're not who they are now.
Yeah.
So, but I do feel, yeah, it would have been weird if I went anywhere else.
So 95. You were getting letters that early?
You get letters like, I mean, I didn't get recruited till junior year.
You get letters that early.
The questionnaire joints.
I think because, 97? Yeah, I started getting letters in 97 too then. Mm-hmm. I guess that is right. All right, so walk me through the Nike spokesman deal. I mean, you were the biggest, you know, person to come out, Nike deal. I mean, did you pick your own shoes? Like, what? Like, let me do that. Cause I never got to pick my own shoes. I wasn't good enough. They just gave me retro Jordans.
Retro Jordans.
I know it's still great though. They give you retro Jordans just to like throw on.
Still wearing them.
And put your number on it. They were like, here.
They put your number on it. That was like highlight. I was like, oh my God, I got my number on my shoes. It's crazy. But basically they always just wanted you to wear, because women, so like Cynthia Cooper, Lisa Leslie, Cheryl Swoops, there was like a period of time there, especially Cheryl, where they had their own shoe.
Yeah.
Especially Cheryl. Cheryl's was like signature shoe. Gotcha. And then at one point, like Shamiqua got one. Another point, Diana had like one or two iterations, but nothing really stuck. So I never had like a signature shoe, but it was always like, hey, this shoe's what's coming out. We want you to wear it. Or this one is what's going to be hitting the market in like a month or two. We want you to wear it. And then, yeah, they'd like personalize it for you. Put your name, whatever, or if you wanted a nickname, your initials, a number.
Yeah.
If you had like a logo kind of a thing going, you could put that on it. So that was always, and then of course it was always in Seattle Storm colors. So it was like truly like a PE.
Yeah. But that had to be huge to the time for.
Dude, it was, this is how huge it was. My first game, they didn't have it ready for game one. And like, I vividly remember this. We played game one of my career at home. We played game two against Portland. This is when the Portland still had a team, Portland Fire. Yep. Yep. So we drive down there and they're like going to present me with this shoe that's like, it's green, it's yellow, it's our colors. It's going to have my initials, my number on it. And it's like, oh, and they're like, here, this is what we want you to wear today. And I'm like, this is so dope. I look, I'm like, I'm a size 7.5 men's. I look, I'm like, it's a size 7. They're like, oh, like they did it in the wrong size. That's a half. I go, that's okay. I'll wear them. I wore a half size smaller just so I could wear the PEs in the game. Like for real, I was like, oh, snug fit, not a problem.
Yeah, no,
like that's how excited I was about it.
Hey, great story, Ron Artest. You know how crazy Ron is.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Ron wanted to wear these pair of retro Jordans that had just dropped. And I'm best friends with Al Harrington. Al calls me. He goes, dude, call me after the game. You got to hear this story. Ron wanted to wear those retros so bad, he took the insoles out and didn't wear socks.
Oh, my God.
And got a triple-double in Miami. I forget what he had, but it was like a big, it was like 28, 13, and 12. With no socks and no insoles.
That's a great untold story.
Yeah, if you want a pair of shoes bad enough, I used to wear like the retro ones, and I thought it would be funny. My feet would be on fire after the game, and I was like, nah, I'm not
like,
doing
they're
that
not made, yeah.
No, they're not made for worn. Like modern day basketball. So how did your rookie year play out? I mean, like walk through like towards the end of the season and, you know, kind of where your mindset was then.
Yeah, basically, if memory serves, like we got to a point and we were definitely like we were an expansion team. This was only, I think, the third year of the franchise at all. I mean, the league was only like, I don't even know, like 5 years old. So I guess, but still. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we get to the end and we were like middle of the pack team, maybe even lower, to be honest. But we had this, our coach, I remember coming in the locker room being like, all right, guys, if we win, I don't remember the exact numbers, but if we win like 7 of our last 9, like, we'll make the playoffs. I'm like, all right, cool. Let's give it a go. And we actually pulled it off.
Awesome.
So it was the first time in franchise history we made the playoffs. I mean, we immediately got swept by the team that ended up winning. So, you know, it is what it is. But it was really cool because it kind of started, I think, what is now, you know, me and Lauren, like our legacy of kind of those first two number one picks at the start of the franchise, like its existence. And we kind of set the tone in that first year together. So it was pretty cool.
Yeah, and I think I touched on a little bit earlier. There's so many times where people think that teammates have to be best friends.
Yeah.
I've never felt like that. I think you
Me
have
neither.
To have mutual respect for one another.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, like, you know, you and Lauren are a prime example of that. You know, just people that love each other in a competitive way as athletes.
Yeah.
And now in the NBA, everybody wants to be best friends and play with their best friend.
Yeah.
could you imagine doing that, looking back now, on like chasing the championship? Like, you guys built that and grew that. Could you chase a championship?
Right. I actually don't think I could. And I'm lucky. I lived it a certain way. I've been in the same franchise my whole career. We've won. So I've kind of had the best of everything. I've been lucky to get paired up with some amazing teammates that made my life a lot easier. And it's funny because a couple years ago, I was talking to Diana Taurasi. Like, we were just kind of chatting about whatever. And it's like, oh, like, what if we could have played together in the WNBA? Because obviously we played overseas together, had great success in college, great success. National team, great success. We're like, man, like, are we stupid? Should we have been doing this? And it's kind of like, I feel like we both kind of looked at each other like, yeah, this would have been great. Our lives would have been so much easier. We could have played together. We probably would have won a bunch. And simultaneously, I guarantee you, I know what I was thinking. I bet she was thinking the same. It's kind of like, in my head, I was like, well, I'm not leaving Seattle.
Yeah.
And I'm sure in her mind, she's like, well, I'm not leaving Phoenix.
Phoenix, exactly.
And so it's like, no one was ever going to jump ship, you know?
No.
So, I don't know.
I mean, you guys also got to put yourselves in a category for everyone listening, like, when I know, like, you guys, I know, are like the Michael Jordan, the Kobe Bryant of your perspective sport. So, people, you didn't have to chase it. You know, like, you guys were good enough that you created the legacy. And I think that that's some of the stuff that's missed right now in the NBA is, if you're good enough, you'll carry your team to that level. You'll find a way to get your team to that level. You don't have to go jump ship and, you know, go play with this guy to win. If you're good enough, it'll find you.
Yeah.
You know?
Totally.
So did you play, what's the first year you played in Russia?
Like 2004, like 2004 or 5.
And what city were you
like
in?
I was in Moscow my first 7 years in Russia.
Yikes.
Nah, you would love it.
I love Russia.
I'm telling you right now, you would love it.
I have a great Russian story.
I'm sure you do. Why am I not surprised? You have great Russian stories. You would absolutely love it.
I did. First time I went was with Andrei Kirilenko.
Oh my God. I can only imagine.
AK was like, dude, you got to come over. You'll love it. So,
It's wild.
I mean,
it's wild.
And even the atmosphere of the female game there. Why do you think it's taken off so much there and kind of struggled over here, especially financially?
Yeah, what's interesting is, like, it's not what you think. It's not like the basketball over there has it all figured out and they know how to market this and that. It's literally just like a totally different model. It's not based on, you know, like, everything in America is based on, like, revenue and ticket sales in terms of pro sports. This is literally based on, like, I honestly don't know of any female owners, so it's safe to say. It's like, this is like dudes who like women's basketball and just want to have the best team and are like competing with the other dudes that do it as well.
And have a ton of money.
Yeah, and they just have crazy money in Russia. Like, the one team I played for at the end of my career, my Russian career, was in this city called Yekaterinburg. And there's this company called UMMC. That was the name of our team also. And it's like Euro Mining Mountain Company. They like literally make gold. I'm like, not even like, they make blocks of gold. We went into like the factory or whatever and saw it. And it's just like crazy money.
Yeah.
And so for them, it was like, this is what a negotiation with them went like. It was like, all right, I'm on a team right now. You know, I'll keep it simple. Like, they're paying me $10. They're like, okay, we're offering you a contract for $12. And I was like, well, I really like my team. Okay, we'll pay you $20. You're like, okay.
Okay, yeah.
Like, they would just like double, triple the money for no reason. Like, it was stupid not to go.
That's
just because they wanted the best team. They were just going to try and get the best players. So every Russian team that one is like on crack, but every Russian team was kind of like similar in that way. Like they just wanted a great team, so they're willing to pay you. Boom, yeah. That was it. Based on nothing else.
And I think that if you look at the model of most sports around the world, besides American sports, it's like that. I mean, Premier League's like that.
Right. You know, they just buy you.
They just buy you. And totally. I mean, there's no way they can justify a transfer fee of, you know, $89 million.
Those transfer fees.
Yeah. $89 million, I'm going to pay you $50 million to come there.
Right.
There's no revenue model based on that. Like, so
exactly.
I agree with you. We, in this country, we use it as an excuse a lot of times. There's a way that you can pay everybody. Mm-hmm. And I know that I always told you, having two daughters, do you think there is an answer to get a more equal level of pay for female athletes to promote female sports? I mean,
yeah. Well, that's the key word, promote. A lot of people think when female athletes speak up on, you know, equal opportunity, equal pay, they think like that, especially as a WNBA player. I mean, like, listen, I'm not an idiot. I'm not sitting here being like, I should be making what LeBron's making just because I play the same sport and equal pay. No, that's not how it works.
Yeah.
But you have to, like, rewind and think about all the money that's been invested, and not just money, time, and, like, thoughtful time in a marketing campaign or how we're going to make this grow. And women have really not gotten that attention.
No,
and so when we say equal pay, yeah, there's certain things in this world where— you know, if a man and a woman are doing the same job, they deserve equal pay. Like, I believe that. But I understand that NBA, WNBA, like, these are businesses, and they're business models that are based on success and revenue.
Yeah.
But I think our point is, you have to promote us in ways that are going to help us be successful.
Correct.
And market us in ways that are going to help. And then from there, we can grow the business with our play, so to speak.
Yeah.
So I think people get lost in that. Like, we're more so being like, no, you have to actually give us the same time and attention.
Well, I mean, it's something that I'm even adamant about. Like, and you go through it, man, flying commercials stinks, okay? It's the worst. So, like, pick small battles, man. Piggyback off of your contract, especially the NBA, piggyback off your contract with the NBA and get charter flights. It doesn't change that much. But, like, you do small things like that, and I think it would also help the promotion of the players, because now you feel like the league itself is actually spending the time to find small things to make your life easier here and there. So now you guys will feel more comfortable going out and promoting it, because it is bad publicity when the players are frustrated. So you have to give them small bones. Like, you have to just throw them a bone here and there.
Yeah, like, sometimes I kind of, as a WNBA player, I get caught like, am I shitting on the league too much? You know, because perception really is everything. And it's like, There's like guy, we'll use the NBA just because it's an easy comparison, but there are guys in the NBA that probably don't make, I'm talking like the lower end, so, but that haven't made as much money as a lot of us who've played overseas.
Yeah.
But because they're in the NBA and the perception is such, you know, and maybe they have a certain car, whatever, people see from the out, and they're like, oh, I'll go to a game, I'll watch that guy.
Yeah.
And it's like perception. And right now, like, our perception's not amazing, and sometimes it can be like a small win, like you were saying with the travel.
Yeah, small
just way, little I mean, things.
Yeah, and I mean, I've never thought about that. Perception is exactly right. NBA has done a great job of glorifying like the flashy lifestyle. It's a great call. I didn't think about that. So you see this kid that doesn't really have it like that, but he has the diamonds. He has this.
Yeah,
and
you
he's promoted.
Assume.
You assume like, oh, look, there's this extravagant lifestyle, and now all these parents just keep pushing their son like, hey, man, go play because of this.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I don't think there's been a good enough job done to show the level of success and kind of a marketing vehicle behind female basketball. Because if there was that, you would have so many more parents pushing their kids like, hey, go do it. You almost see a better vehicle in gaming. Like, when I work in video games now, like, they've done a good job to say, oh, this kid making $3 million playing video games. Every parent's like, go play video games, kid. It's like, wait a minute. That's one kid out
one
of the
guy. Right.
Out of the 400 million that do it. Let's scale that back. So the game you had against the Portland Fire, it's August 9th. It was at the time your career high. What's your career high now?
Yeah, I think it might be the same. A different game, but
you had your career high in your rookie year?
Yeah, but I like hit that number. I don't know. I'd have to go look.
Yeah, I don't know either.
If it's 1 point higher, that would be about it. But yeah, I came out hot, you know?
You came out
and
hot,
then it just kind of died down. No.
No, I mean, so you have that. And
yeah, that game was crazy.
Yeah, I say this. Everybody has that one defining moment in their career mm-hmm. when they're like, all right, I can do this. Especially mm-hmm. when you get to the pros, you're like, you need that, just that one moment. For me, we were playing against Boston, and Paul Pierce was cooking. It was when they had like Paul Pierce and Antoine Walker. Yeah. And MJ was like, you got this, man. Go guard Paul. And I guarded Paul the whole fourth quarter, and we won. And like the fact that Michael Jordan was like, you got this, and I actually did it, I was like, I'm an NBA player now. I'm an NBA player. Was that game for you? What was that moment for you when?
Yeah, that probably was it, because I'd had like a very good season, so it wasn't, you know, I had some big games, but it was what was riding on that game that mm-hmm. that really kind of I don't know, gave me like this different kind of confidence, this different kind of air about me. And basically, like I was telling you guys earlier, we had to win like a lot of games in order just to make the playoffs. Like I think it was like 7 out of 9 or something crazy like that. And then when we got to that Portland game, we still had a game after that, but this was the way the records panned out. We absolutely had to win that game.
That's awesome.
Absolutely had to win it. Like it was us or them at that point.
Yeah.
And, you know, because Portland's not that far from Seattle, they used to call it the I-5 rivalry. Yeah. And a lot of their fans came up. The building was sold out, which was crazy. So we talk about atmosphere. Like, that game had the atmosphere that we're talking about. Like, it was rocking in there. And then, yeah, like, I don't even know what happened. Like, I don't know. I blinked. The game was over. I was like, oh, my God, we won. I had 33 points. What the hell just happened? It was wild.
That's so cool, man.
Yeah. And then, sidebar. So the next game, we had to win. We had to win, but like if another team lost, we could have lost. It was like really down to the, so we did going in, we thought we had to win.
Yeah.
Guess how many points I had?
How many?
Zero. I went from dropping 33 to dropping none. Zero. Donut. I was like,
how many shots did you shoot?
Not a lot. We won by a lot. We ended up winning by a lot, and the game actually didn't matter at the end, anyways. But it was funny. What a swing!
No, you got to go get a layup. You got to cherry pick. Get a layup.
She's at the end.
At the end, just like, hey, I'll be down there. Just stand like underneath the basket,
oh
just
God.
Get one and
Zero.
Lay one in.
How terrible!
So, do you think that obviously you've had, like I said, one of the greatest careers, and you've really focused on winning throughout your career? Mm-hmm. Do you think that you'll laugh about LeBron? Always says he can average more points. Do you think that you could have been a much higher score, or this was just a role that you adapted to and that you wanted to have?
I think this role definitely fits like my nature, like who I am. I think it played out the way it was supposed to. I think if I was a little more selfish, I probably could have scored more points, averaged more points. There were times in my career where, you know, our main scorers would go out with injury. Like Lauren had a couple of seasons where she was out and like, boom, I go from averaging like 10, 11 points to like 14, 15.
Yeah.
You know, so I know I had it in me. It's just not necessarily like what I prefer. I think like I'm more of like, I'd rather the team kind of like flow, and that's how, because I know ultimately I can't score, no doubt. Ultimately, I'm not going to be the main scorer on a team that wins a championship.
Yeah.
I'm going to be like the brains, the facilitator, and if you leave me open, I will hit it. So don't do that. But you know what I mean? Like, that's more like where I thrive.
And it's also, I always said this, I play with scores. Mm-hmm. You have to love to score, and you're right, it's a mental makeup. You almost have to be an asshole. Like,
honestly, like, yes, like, totally. I couldn't agree more.
To be a
You literally just like, you can't give a shit, you can't care. All you're focused on is this one thing. You don't care about anybody else.
No.
And that's it.
No,
that's great.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you look at the greatest scorers of all time, with the exception maybe of Kareem,
mm-hmm.
because he was so unique. Mm-hmm. The rest of them, man, like these guys are all pricks, man. Like,
and we mean that with like,
love and affection.
Much.
Yeah, love and affection.
Yeah, love and affection.
Great players, but like they had that edge that,
totally.
All right, if you don't want it, if you don't want the ball, I'll shoot 45 times. Watch this. Like, I don't care. Like, watch me work. So, who right now, coming up in basketball, reminds you most of yourself?
Of myself? Courtney Vandersloot, probably. Yeah. She's point guard for Chicago.
Yeah.
I mean, she's not, like, coming up. She's definitely, like, here. She's been, you know, one of the top point guards in the league for a couple years now.
So, sweetie,
she's probably
old.
In her, like...
We're old now. I mean,
I know, we're old. I know, right?
Like, We keep,
if I had retired 3 years ago, this would have made a lot more sense. But yeah, but she's definitely, because she's like, sees the floor, has like an amazing feel for that aspect of the game, like finding her teammates.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're similar in that way. We're similar in the fact that we can score when needed. I think we go about it a little differently, but that's just, you know, you got to be who you are. But I think that's who's probably who I see a lot of myself in.
That's awesome. So overall, your rookie season, huge success, small success. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
Rookie season, huge success.
Huge. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, we got swept in the first round of the playoffs. Which actually turned into our calling card until we won. But nobody expected that of us. I think we rose to the occasion in different ways. Lauren and I hated each other that rookie year. We ended up being friends, and that we still are friends. We ended up being great friends, actually, but that didn't come until later.
Mm-hmm.
But right out the gate, it was like, okay, these two play these two complement each other. They play really well, and we can now build on that. So to me, it was a huge success.
What is Sue Bird going to be doing in 3 years?
Man, I'll go out on a limb. It's safe to say I'll be retired. I can't imagine. It's just getting physically harder and harder. So I think I do have a couple years. I don't know. Three is a stretch.
Yeah.
So when I'm retired at that point, I don't know. I think the cool thing about, I actually would love for the WNBA to play in the winter. I'll just throw that out there. But in my lifetime, it hasn't. It's in the summer. So and the overseas thing is in the winter. So the cool thing is that once I stopped playing overseas, I still was playing basketball, but I also had time in the offseason. So the most recent thing I've done is worked with the Nuggets.
Yeah.
Just an opportunity to kind of see how that world works. I've done some commentating prior to that. Again, like opportunity to like see how, like if I vibe with it, if it's cool, if I like it, you know, do I see myself doing it? So I don't know. I mean, this is a big disappointment. I don't know that I have an answer for you, but I think I can't imagine it's not something with basketball, whether it's commentating or front office, whether, you know, that's NBA, WNBA, whatever, or even coaching. I mean, that's the one thing I haven't really tried, but.
Don't do that.
I don't know. Don't do that.
No, it's way too much work. Way too much work.
Way too much film. I know. I'd be like doing the grunt stuff at the start. Too.
Well, not even now. Like you're such
a
basketball.
Homeboy be calling me up at midnight. Like, can you come rebound?
No, it wouldn't be that at all. You're such a basketball junkie that, and it's been your whole life. Your losses as a coach feel more helpless because you're not actually out there playing.
Right.
So the amount of film that you would watch, you would never leave. You'd be in the arena. You'd be the one making your coaches come in at midnight. Like, hey, come here and watch this. We gotta go over the defensive scheme for tomorrow. You'd be there all the time.
Yeah, I will it does say take this. Up your life. That yeah, I definitely know.
It takes up so much of your life.
Yeah.
The praises that have been saying about you from the front office of Nuggets, you could definitely and will definitely, if you decide to do it, be a very high-level executive at any level of basketball. I mean, I've never seen a group of guys be more complimentary of anyone, female or male. They spoke your praises, you know, upteen. And I think that's cool. I mean, even the guys that we had come in, former players, interns, you know, they were like, whatever. But the praise they sang about you and your feel for the game itself, that was big time.
Thank you. I got really lucky. I mean, you know, it's like a great group.
Yeah, it really is.
I got lucky that, you know, Tim called me, literally. Yeah. So I feel, I don't know, I got to learn a lot from them. Because there is so much. I mean, that's the one thing with the NBA. There's just so much. There's just so much. So many players to learn. It's crazy.
Well, it's also, too, it's one of those things that they keep creating more jobs. It's like, the more money, the revenue that the NBA has, you look up and there's 12 coaches. Like, why do you, wait a minute, you have.
That's how I feel about the front office, too. People be like, what's your title? And I'm like, listen, my title might be this here, and somebody else will have a similar title. They're doing something totally different.
Yeah.
Or there's a president, a GM. What's the difference? I don't know. Like, some teams have one, some teams don't. It's funny.
It's just got so big. I mean, now you're talking about you have literally 12 coaches. Like, what does he do?
He's
player development for the bigs.
Player development,
what does he do? Player development for the guards. What does he do? He just rebounds. Does he get a travel? Yeah, he travels. I go, he gets per diem, gets to fly private, and he just rebounds? I said, I need his job.
Sign me up.
I know, right? Who is your biggest rival in the league? Like, who is somebody that...
Like one player?
I mean, it could be one player, it could be two players, but like, for me, honestly, I mean, I don't know if it was a rivalry, but anytime that I played against Tracy McGrady,
Yeah.
I was so scared because I was like, this guy can score 70 any night. And he did score 70 points one night.
Yeah.
He scored, never forget this. He scored 70. He had like 4 or 5 points in the first quarter. They subbed me out. By the time I get back in the second quarter, he has like 18. And I like had that look in his eye, and I was like, I wonder if I should fake an injury real quick and get up into this buzzsaw. He had 70, and he missed 10 free throws that game.
Oh, my God.
Wowzers. So, yeah, I mean, who was
he
that?
He probably thinks of that more than you do.
I know, right?
Like, those 10 free throws.
I know. Who was that person that, you know, like that person, that, like every time you see him, you got up for?
Yeah. The one player that I think throughout my time, anytime, and this is like as a point guard, obviously, you know, like Diana, I could actually throw her in this because we're such good friends and our teams have always been really good. And we've met in the playoffs a bunch of times, but we don't guard each other. So it's like different, you know, it just like doesn't count.
Nah.
So the one player where it's like every time we were getting ready to play their team, it was like, okay, like here we go, is Lindsey Whalen.
Oh, wow.
And that's because, so we're close. We're pretty close in age. We actually met. I mean, looking back now, I didn't know it in the moment, but we met in the WNBA finals. It was my third year in the league, her first.
Okay.
And our two teams met in the WNBA finals. And like, I mean, that if that didn't tell a story of what was going to happen with the two of us, we're actually really good friends. And, you know, on the national team, we were the 2 point guards for the national team for a really long time.
Yep.
I believe she has 2 or 3 gold medals. I can't remember. So it's like, but we're also kind of like each other's measuring stick, you know, stick. Like we set the standard for each other. And she was on a Minnesota team that really was setting the standard for the league for a long time. Like they won like a lot. And she was the head of that. So every time, you know, we faced each other, I think we could probably both honestly admit, like, we knew it was like, all right, this is go time.
Yeah.
Like this is, I got to win this game, but I got to win this individual matchup.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I mean, if you went back, I don't even know. I mean, her team was definitely better than mine for like a very extended period of time. They were just that good. I mean, they were better than everybody.
Yeah.
But I think through the years, I mean, I had some great games. She had some great games. I had some bad games. She had some not so good games. So it's like, it was up and down, but we always went at it.
Where does your competitive nature come from? I mean, like, do you think that you just always had it or?
Definitely.
Always?
I mean, I was like the little kid cheating at Candyland. You know what I mean? Like, the stories in my family of, you know, that are kind of famous, I guess, is like I was on a track team when I was like 5 or something. And I'm like running and it was a relay. So I was actually waiting for the baton. That's what it was. The person was running. I got the baton. I looked up. Everybody, like the rest of the field has like already finishing. We were dead last. I just took the baton, threw it, walked off. I was like, I got no time for this losing crap. So like from an early age, that was just always how super, super competitive, probably a sore loser. So I had to learn to channel that part, but that was just in me.
I mean, it is. I think certain people develop it, other people just always have it. And it seems like a lot of the greatest at whatever the sport is, it was always there. And it was just one of those things that you always have it, but you cultivate it, and it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. So, everybody hate to talk about it. All your knee injuries.
Yeah.
So, how hard is it to come back? I mean, obviously, you're going through it right now.
Yeah.
And you have to have that edge and that competitiveness to do it. How many surgeries have you had?
On my knee?
How many knees? Yeah.
This one was lucky number 6.
Lucky number 6.
I'd have to count.
And I mean, the rehab process coming back, how do you handle that?
You know, I have to admit, like this one's a little different because so I tore my ACL in college, so I got a very early taste of like what that was. And ACLs obviously, of all my surgeries, the ACL was probably one of the more challenging. I had microfracture also like shortly a couple years after that. That was probably the hardest. But so very, very early, I got a taste of like what, you know, a difficult rehab was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
This one, it's not, So early in my early surgery days, you know, I was young. So it was just like, nope, I'll be back.
Yep.
This one's a little different because there's elements every time I wake up and it feels a little like stiffer than it should. I'm like, oh my God, is this it? Like, oh my God, am I never going to come back again? Because I'm at the end, you know? And I think it's like one part of me wants to finish the right way, not the right way, wants to finish the way I want to finish, which is on the court.
Yeah.
another part of me knows, like, this knee has been through it.
A lot.
Like, this thing has been through it. So, you know, and it's hung on this long. Is it, like, just had enough?
No. Nah.
And I think you kind of teeter back and forth. And then really all you can do is, you know, go to rehab that day and just try to kill it, you know, and not overdo it, not get too caught up in the highs and lows. But there are definitely times at night where I'm like I feel something and I'm like, oh my God, what does that mean? You know, actually a wild roller coaster. I have to get off it.
You do. And I mean, you sit there and I forget who I was talking to, but it's the mindset of an athlete. If the average person had the injuries that we've had and we've gone through, they would just be like, you know what, I'm done. If they do it mm-hmm. skiing, or if they did it riding birds, or they'd be like, I'm not riding a bird ever again. I'm almost out of
that. Yo, I just talked to somebody the other day. He was kind of like a noon ball type of guy. He played in college, like D2 or something. And like, you know, after college, he kind of put, and then he was like, yeah. And then I don't remember what his injury was. He was like, yeah. And then I like tore my meniscus and I was like, yeah, I don't want to do this anymore. You know, and I was like, what do you mean? You just get that scoped?
Yeah, you get scoped.
4 to 6 weeks,
deal.
You're good.
Yeah, couple weeks, you come back from it. Like, it's the mindset of an athlete that you think that you're superhuman. You mm-hmm. honestly believe that, like, hey, man, this is going to hurt, and I'll be okay. Like, no big deal. Right. I'll rehab, and I'll be the same player I was. And you essentially do. You get back there. Modern medicine is great. But it's funny that you have these major injuries that the average person, if they had it, would be devastated. You're just like, oh, no big deal. Like,
I was relieved this time. They were like, okay, listen, you know, this can be surgically repaired. And, you know, doctors, I feel like anybody, who wants to have surgery? Nobody.
Nobody.
And doctors are like, hey, you know, might have to have surgery. I was like, surgery? You can fix this? Great. Like, when are we doing it? Sign me up. But like, I'm ready. Like, I was excited to know that it could be surgically repaired, which is so twisted when you think about it.
But it is, but it's also, like you said, you want to go out and you want to make sure that stuff, that it does, man, that it ends and it happens your way. I mm-hmm. mean, that's kind of like, even when I retired, Tim offered me a job. And I was like, I could fight and struggle, try to hang on, get a 10-day here, get a non-guaranteed deal here.
Right.
Or go to the next phase of my life. And I was like, next phase, here I come. Like,
yeah,
I just got out of there. So when you, right now, obviously, we'll go like real quick about another 2 or 3 minutes. You and Megan are the forefront for equal rights, like I said, and having two daughters. My daughter is so excited right now. And I promised her that at some point in the next year that she'd come hang out with you. So you got a play date with the 11-year-old.
All right, that's good. So I have to download TikTok, whatever it's called.
Yeah, you gotta get TikTok or make TikTok videos. She'll be so excited for you.
Okay.
What do you see as the road to success and what you guys are fighting for? Is there, first of all, a road for success, and what is it?
Yeah, I do. I do believe that. I think that's like a heavy question. I think that, you know, we're both in our own worlds right now, have different fights.
Yeah.
For Megan with soccer, it's like a legit equal pay situation with her federation.
Yeah.
For WNBA, it's a little different because we're more of like a business. But I think in both of our worlds, we have an opportunity to really like start the change. You know, I think it took, you know, it's kind of like, oh God, I wish I did this 10 years ago. But I don't think anyone was ready.
No,
I probably wasn't ready. Like society wasn't ready.
No.
And yet here we are, and we actually have a chance.
Yeah.
To make a huge impact and start this change. And then really what it's about from there is, I guess, paying it forward and then wanting this younger generation, kind of teaching them. Like, I take a lot of pride in that. In my team in Seattle with our younger players,
mm-hmm.
I really try to help them understand, like, what's what, why things are the way they are, and what needs to change.
Yeah.
And so I think the more you can kind of teach the youth, if you will, the longer, you know, this fight, well, not the longer it'll go, because obviously we hope it ends, but I guess the more ready these younger players will be to continue the fight and then eventually turn the corner. But we're definitely at a unique point in time.
Yeah, I mean...
But I don't know the exact... I actually don't know the exact answer to your question.
I don't either.
The one thing that could do it.
I struggle with it all the time because obviously I think a lot of the injustice in this country has been bred in over generations.
Yeah.
And we're trying to change it all really in a 5-year period. I mean, I think that President Obama was a huge part of that. And I think that what Michelle had, what she did when she was in office to draw attention, and obviously people like yourself and Megan, but it's, we're trying to change generational ignorance in in 5 years, which is, I hope that we don't get frustrated, we don't, you know, and we keep the momentum going. But
right.
I don't know. Go ahead.
Sorry, I think you bring up a good point, like representation.
Yeah.
You know, I think representation matters more now than well, I mean, it's always mattered, but we never really, for whatever reason, we've just been like, it's the same people in the same positions that look the same, and they've been making the same decisions, you know, for years. And it's like, we're finally disrupting that and changing that. And that's probably, in terms of like politics, that's probably one of the most important things. But even like the heads of businesses,
exactly.
You know? What you can talk about some of the clothing brands, we'll keep them nameless, I guess, but that did some like crazy racist stuff. It was probably because like there weren't people in the room to be like, excuse me, that ain't cool. And like that needs to change.
Yeah. I think you talk about two things. Politically, it's definitely changed. And from an economic standpoint, you have so many younger generation kids that finally have money. Before, it was always the same guard. It was the same, you know, like you said, the same guy that looks the same, sounds the same, that, you know, has the house in the Hamptons, has a house in Florida.
I'm from Long Island.
Exactly.
And, you know that house in the Hamptons.
Exactly.
Well, I don't have one, but I know it.
Exactly. And he lives in a penthouse in the city, and he can pretty much control. Now, the wealth is still there, and he's still, but it's being distributed amongst our generation and even younger, to a level that they have like set money, and they're able to back people they want. They're able to have fundraisers, they're able to have events to raise awareness. And mainstream media and this younger level of younger generation of wealth, I think, is going to be instrumental in this. You know, they have to help.
I agree.
You know, so we have to keep going. But listen, I am so thrilled that you came on.
I know. I'm so glad. Thanks for having me.
Sue, I want to thank you for coming in and telling the story of your rookie year with us. You can follow Sue on IG at SBird10 and on Twitter at S10Bird. I'm your host, Jared Jeffries, and you can follow me on IG and Twitter at Modern Fishing TV. Thank you to DCP Entertainment. Listen and subscribe to Rookie Year on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your shows. And for more, go to dcpofficial.com.